If you believe in democracy, you believe in the capacity of each individual voter to make an informed judgment. And to make an informed judgment, you have to hear all the sides in an argument.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Lambert Opick on the state of freedom in Britain and why we need to stop cancel culture.
Britain's in a parlous state when it comes to freedom of speech now. It's almost a badge of honour to silence the opposition.
Lambert talks about the difficulties of challenging the mainstream climate narrative.
You get cowed and you get threatened, you get intimidated and you get dismissed if you challenge the arguments, even though I say with unequivocal certainty that the climate fanatics, the catastrophists, are 100% wrong.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with Lambert Opick, broadcaster and former Member of Parliament. Lambert, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
You're probably best known for your 13 years in Parliament, but since then you've been involved in various social issues. I wanted to start talking with you about freedom, really. What do you think about the state of freedom in Britain today?
I'm not sure what I am best known for, but I'm not known as a libertarian. And ironically, that's the reason I got into politics. I can't stand authoritarianism. I can't stand it when people get squashed into conformity just because the other side isn't comfortable with having the argument. Turning to your question, Britain's in a parlous state when it comes to freedom of speech now. It's almost a badge of honour to silence the opposition. Two examples, with the green agenda, you're called a climate change denier if you say that you don't think human beings are wrecking the planet. Now, there are two things wrong with that. I actually think that the climate change deniers are the people who think that we can stop climate change. I think it's a naturally occurring process. But instead, we've got this Holocaust illusion to people who, like me, think that the science just doesn't support the climate agenda. And yet, even the BBC, the state-sponsored station, has said, we don't have to have balance on this. We're not going to take the contrary view. A second example would probably be the woke agenda, where sexual and gender politics has occupied centre stage for a lot of the time. You've got a man who wants to be Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who says that 99.9% of women don't have a penis. It's an awkward statement to begin with. But secondly, I think, well, how did he do that research? And more than anything, what does he mean by it? Now, I used to be one of the judges on the UK Transsexual Awards, and I have no issue with anyone's gender, but I do have an issue when British politics becomes a virtue-signalling woke situation where it's almost impossible to express a contrary view without being cancelled.
Hmm. What are some of the big erosions of freedom that we've seen in recent years that you think are real problems now?
There are three really big problems, I think, in terms of free speech in the UK. The first one is about gender politics. The Tavistock Institute, which seemed to be trying to condition people to think in a different way about gender, has done incalculable damage, but seemed to be on the side of the authorities for a long time, until it was called out by people like Amy Gallagher, who's one of the leading campaigners against that kind of thing. The second example is the green agenda, where the government has bought hook, line and sinker a scientifically illiterate claim that carbon dioxide generated by human beings is wrecking the climate. It's impossible due to technical things like logarithmic decay and spectral absorption and so on. They're very technical things, but the politicians haven't even heard of that. So we've got this economically significant self-destruction going on the basis of something that most people don't even understand. And the third example, I think, is in terms of international affairs. The most infamous example from when I was an MP was the fake justification for a war in Iraq. We now know it was an illegal war. No one's gone to prison for it. No one's been prosecuted for it. But 1.5 million Iraqis are dead because of it. And I think that carries on now with how we present the Ukraine situation. It's never really presented in a holistic way. Wherever you stand on it, you should hear both sides before you actually take a position.
How important is it, do you think, to hear the other side and for both sides of a story to be aired?
It's absolutely vital that both sides of a story, and sometimes more than two sides of a story, are heard. Why? Because if you believe in democracy, You believe in the capacity of each individual voter to make an informed judgment. And to make an informed judgment, you have to hear all the sides in an argument. If you don't believe in democracy, it's fine. You don't really need to have a free press. You don't need to have a free debate. You can cancel people who don't go with the zeitgeist. And therein lies the contradiction. Because the people who tell us that, oh, it's wrong to question the climate emergency, also tell us they believe in democracy. You can't have it both ways, folks. I find it almost impossible to get green fundamentalists to engage with me in a media environment because I think they know they're going to lose. Well, that tells you everything you need to know. The problem with oppression is it's normally the people with a weaker argument who are doing the oppressing.
Do you think the public are kind of aware of the freedoms that are being eroded, or are we the frog in the water that's being heated and we're not realised we're being cooked?
We're the frog in the water. I would say that by and large, the kind of things that you and I are discussing aren't the direct purvey of the general public who are just about managing, who are dealing with a tripling of their mortgages, who are worried about their kid being bullied in school. They don't say, now let's talk about the libertarian agenda and free speech. And that's why the authoritarians get away with it. It's only when it makes a practical difference to the reasonable person on the Clapham omnibus that they begin to notice. Give you an example. Most people in Britain don't realise they're not going to be allowed to buy a petrol-engined or diesel-engined vehicle after 2030 if Keir Starmer gets elected and keeps his idiotic promise on that. Once they realise that, they won't say, let's review the environmental motivation for this. They'll simply say, you're going to take my car away? I'm taking my vote away. And that's why there's such a big disconnect. This high moral purpose by the green fanatics means nothing to most people until something is lost. Of course, everyone's paying higher energy bills because of this stupid policy, but they don't make the connection with the green agenda. They make the connection with something that's happened. If they really did understand that politicians are directly responsible for essentially a tripling of energy prices, they probably wouldn't vote for them.
Let's go a bit more into this green agenda. You've talked quite a bit about it in the media. And what are your thoughts on the mainstream climate narrative?
There is no climate crisis. Climate change has done ever since the Earth was formed. The atmosphere in its approximately current state came about 2.5 billion years ago. We've had very warm periods, about warm, maybe 49 Celsius even, which is a lot warmer than now. Very cold periods where the Earth itself has frozen, snowball Earth, if you like, maybe with a bit of slush on the equator. This is the normal process of the Earth. If carbon dioxide was a determinant that could create a runaway greenhouse situation, it would have happened long ago. Not to get too technical about it, when the dinosaurs were around, the atmosphere was much denser and there's much more carbon dioxide. It was warmer. It wasn't a lot warmer. And we've had ice ages. The big problem here is the public doesn't realise that if carbon dioxide goes below a certain level, which technically is 150 parts per million, everything dies. The plants die. And then we die. We haven't got a problem with carbon dioxide. It's our friend. Now, my father was a nuclear physicist. My grandfather was an astronomer. I had my first thing published on this in around 1980. So I think I know what I'm talking about. The problem here, writ large, in terms of the oppression of free speech is, I'm not allowed to say that in a lot of the mainstream media, or the lamestream media is often called now. Why? Because they haven't got a response, but they want to conform. Perhaps some of them will think they're going to lose their funding if they don't conform. I'm liberated to say the science as I see it, and also to tell people, if you've got a better argument, come back to me, explain why I'm wrong. That's the essence of free speech, and it's missing in the climate argument. Even more so, you get cowed, and you get threatened, you get intimidated, and you get dismissed if you challenge the arguments, even though I say with unequivocal certainty that the climate fanatics, the catastrophists, are 100% wrong.
Why is there such an aversion to having a debate if these people think they're right? Why are they not happily debating? Well, where does it come from, the push against the discussion?
There are three reasons why the climate debate is so perverted in its abandonment of free speech. First of all, massive vested interest. There are lots of people who are making a lot of money by creating essentially economically unviable technology to cut carbon dioxide. So the second reason is political influence, where people who really didn't have a chance of having any influence are now wagging the dog of politics. The Green Party's great achievement is getting the two main parties to buy into their arguments hook, line and sinker. And I, having been a politician myself, I can see that power is a great motivator for a lot of people. Third reason is people who can't be bothered to church, go to church, want a religion, and that religion is the climate emergency. This isn't new. We've been seeing people walking around with the end of the world as nigh on their backs and on their fronts for decades, and really that's happened long before even the birth of Jesus. So we do seem to have a catastrophist mindset that there's going to be a moment of revelation and so forth. Maybe it'll happen, but it hasn't happened yet. So I think that there's almost a theistic reason for it as well. You put all that together, there's this monolithic, slavish adherence to this belief.
These green agenda items, they tend to affect the pockets of the ordinary person. If you look at the ULEZ charges, obviously the various net zero agenda requirements, Scotland's even consulting on making heat pumps mandatory. You were a politician for a long time, you understand how all this stuff works. Do you think the public have been properly consulted and properly informed?
The public have been neither consulted nor warned, more than informed, nor warned of the consequences. Heat pumps just aren't going to make your house as warm as a gas boiler or a coal fire boiler or, frankly, a wood burner. And the changes that are being required in this incredibly authoritarian way, totalitarian way, are just being imposed. The public accept it to an extent because they don't see an alternative. Well, they haven't until recently. Labour and Conservative pretty much completely aligned on the same idiotic, ludicrous green agenda, which isn't going to save a single life, but it will cost a few lives because some people will freeze who would have otherwise survived, particularly the elderly. But they get away with it, again, because it's a technically very complicated subject. If I was to explain to you how an internal combustion engine works, number one, you'd probably lose interest. Number two, you might be a bit baffled about it. Why does compression matter? What's a four-stroke cycle? But you drive a car, so you depend on, if you've got a normal, an old-fashioned car, you depend on the internal combustion engine to work without necessarily needing to see how it works under the bonnet. What the government's doing now is it's messing with the engine, so your engine's going to work worse and it's going to cost you more. And as a non-mechanic, you'll notice it's worse without maybe noticing why. But they've got away this far because it's a very technical subject, and most people do lose interest when you start talking about the details.
So what can we do? I mean, you're obviously very passionate about this subject, but what do you feel we can do to make things better?
There are two things we can do. One is the moral high ground, and the other is the practical campaigning reality. The moral high ground is to engage with the people who are trying to impose all this rubbish on us and demand that they justify it. They can't, and that's where the cancellation comes. Because they simply say, the science is settled. The science is never settled. Anybody who knows about Karl Popper, who's a great philosopher about this, knows the science is never settled. So we can talk about all those things that I mentioned and the logarithmic decay and the spectral absorption of CO2 and the main greenhouse gas, which is, of course, water vapor. People aren't that interested in it. They're more interested in who's in the jungle and whether Nigel Farage is going to be leader of the Conservative Party and that sort of thing. The second thing is much more practical and much more applicable. If you go along with this particular agenda, here are the consequences to you as an individual.
Yeah, you won't be financial.
Financial. You won't be able to buy the car you want. You'll have a car which, if it's secondhand, will probably do 80 miles. And you won't be able to go and see your granny in Wales without stopping three times. And if you go along with this agenda, mate, you're going to be paying three, four, five times more for your energy, and there could be power cuts because we won't have enough power to keep the country going. And on top of that, we will give the economic keys of the world to the countries that don't give a damn about this, or at least they don't apply it. China. We've exported all our CO2 to China, and then we buy everything back from them. They're still making CO2 when they manufacture our products. that makes more sense to people. And even that last point isn't so important. Do you really look at the label on your shoe, made in Brazil, made in Britain? Most people don't. So it's really when it begins to hurt people's pockets and begins to restrict their freedoms, like low traffic zone, neighborhoods restrict people's freedoms, like cycle lanes which jam up, almost empty cycle lanes, by the way, which jam up the proper traffic, the meaningful, economically and socially significant traffic, where you've got two kids in the back and you're taking granny to the doctors.
Do you feel enthusiastic that we're going to see some kind of change soon?
I am enthusiastic that things are going to change. Why? Because I've been campaigning on this for a decade. I've been studying it for most of my life. Now people are beginning to notice that actually a hybrid vehicle may be incinerated an entire car park at Luton Airport. Why haven't we been told the brand of that vehicle? I think I know what it is, and I think it was its 50-kilo battery that was inextinguishable once it started burning, a known fault, I think, in the particular brand, that meant that you had essentially a great big incendiary device in the middle of the car park. It shut down an airport for a day, probably did about £90 million worth of damage. That's a pretty expensive insurance claim. If that happens again and there are fatalities, people begin to think differently. And this is a gruesome prospect, but it could be the damage that these decisions make that causes a change of heart in the decision makers, not perhaps because they particularly care, but they care about their futures and their votes. And if you can prove that we have a fatally injurious green agenda, the people won't tend to vote for that.
I wanted to talk to you a bit about wokeness. Can you start by telling us, you know, what is wokeness and why do you think the public should be opposed to it?
The word woke was invented about 100 years ago in the United States, and it was a worthwhile and worthy endeavour. The idea was to be aware of social circumstances and cultural differences and to respect them. Nice idea. The word's been hijacked because now, if you are not a green catastrophist, you're not woke. If you're not in favour of unlimited immigration, you're a racist, not woke. If you dare to say that there's a disproportionate focus on gender politics, you're not woke. So it's been weaponized by people who claim to be woke, people who fly around the world in private jets telling us not to fly, 70,000 of them going to Dubai for a conference where I bet you just about everyone flew, to say that we've got to cut our CO2 production. The problem with woke for me is that the people who are its primary practitioners aren't actually walking the talk. They tell us what to do without doing it themselves. Emma Thompson, an actress I used to respect, flew to the UK to join a climate demonstration. I don't really need to express the irony. Joe Biden took a Boeing 747, one of the biggest planes in the world, all the way to Tel Aviv to hug Benjamin Netanyahu. Other people might have used Zoom if they were really concerned about the 150,000 kilograms of CO2 that his individual flight created. It wasn't even a business jet. It was a full-size jumbo. That's where it goes wrong, because the woke advocates aren't woke themselves.
Who do you think is behind this kind of rise of the woke culture? We've all seen it over previous decades.
I think there are a number of interest groups who are really pushing the woke agenda. Back to vested interest again. If you haven't really been in an economically or politically profitable situation, but you get the opportunity to have that control by altering the game plan, why wouldn't you do it? So I think there are a lot of people who have been on the outside who are now on the inside because they're the woke priests. So who are the power groups? There's an economic group, people who are into the green sustainable energy agenda, can now make money with technology which essentially isn't economically viable when you compare it to fossil fuel alternatives like coal. You've got a political elite who think, mistakenly in my view, they're going to garner votes by talking about this stupid green agenda. And then thirdly, you've got zealots who genuinely believe and want to believe that human beings are at the heart of the end of the world. The same people who probably thought that the universe orbited around the Earth a few thousand years ago. On top of that, you've actually got vested interests in other countries. Countries that want to see the West emasculate itself economically, and that for them, the Greens are useful idiots, who I suspect they sponsor, and amazingly, they have inroads into decision makers, as I say, largely in Western countries.
You were an MP for 13 years. You were kind of on the inside, if you like. And do these MPs, when they talk about the woke stuff, do they really believe it, would you say? Or is it something they're just saying to, because they think it will get them support?
Most politicians don't really embrace the woke agenda, but they won't say so publicly. Right. It's awkward because we've now got a media which has been so sidetracked by these conversations that a member of parliament, or maybe even a member of the House of Lords, is loath to hand in their opportunity to be on the media by being accused of being unwoke. This is totalitarianism writ large, really. So they say to me, yeah, well, I know it's a bit stupid, but we'll have to go along with it then, but no one's being harmed by it. No, they're wrong. The whole society's being harmed by this idiocy. But there'll be a small number of people who really try to cling on to it as genuinely serious advocates of wokeness, but most of them aren't. Why are they doing it? Why don't they collectively stand up against it? Well, it's groupthink. And everyone's waiting to see who jumps first. Ironically, back to Nigel Farage again, he doesn't go along with it. He calls it out. He took on the establishment and he won. Brexit happened because the establishment was woking its way towards Remain, while Nigel Farage, whether you like him or not, was speaking more like the cowed, the oppressed public, who then voted quietly to leave the European Union. A complete, clear, prima facie example of what happens if you overwork politics.
Lambert Opeth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.